Hey, Buttheads, welcome back to Bob Zemeckis is Not a Butthead. I am Richard. Hey, Kyle, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, Richard. How are you doing?
Coming in hot this morning. I don't know where that burst of energy came from, but it's Back
caffeine,
to the Future.
Richard.
Caffeine, I did have some this morning. I also did rewatch Back to the Future 3 in the lead up to this. I started, it's like a movie morning thing. I've been considering doing that for the last few weeks, and I kind of did
Richard,
it this
how many
morning.
Times have you watched Back to the Future 3 in preparation for this podcast?
Three times.
All right. Well, it is the third film, so that is that is the appropriate number.
I've watched most of them three times, and that's yes. I was meditating on that this morning, and they're just so rewatchable that I never even batted an eye against watching it three times. Here we are, and I enjoyed it all three times.
Yes.
I love this movie, and I don't think I realized how much I loved it until I rewatched it. And we kind of touched on that with Back to the Future 2. I found so much after Back to the Future 2, I found so much working for me in this kind of a return to some simplicity. It feels like with 2 having got some big special effects stuff out of the way, there's not a whole lot of like crazy motion camera stuff. It's just like him telling a simple, straightforward story and having all the kind of long take fun and the gags with like the magnifying glass in front of his mouth, which is just so silly and wonderful.
I agree. I enjoyed watching this tremendously. This time, Richard, we're talking about Back to the Future 3. It's a Western. It's the final film in a trilogy of podcasts as well. We've talked about one. We've talked about two. We've said brilliant things. We have inspired people. And now we're here to talk about part three. it was really interesting I don't think I realized until I started watching the movie that it had genuinely been a while. Mm-hmm. Since I had watched it, I feel like I've definitely kept up with 1 over the years. I've revisited perhaps parts of 2 intermittently, but it has been a good long while since I've sat down and watched 3 all the way through. And so the first takeaway was, after years of not having seen it, just sort of getting a little bit of perspective, the first takeaway right off the bat was just how different it was in tone and in in feel, I'll just say that, than the other two films. Mm-hmm. In that it's a film that does feel like it sits still. It looks a little bit it examines Doc. It examines Doc and Marty and their relationship as characters, and which has an interesting which I think, and we can get to this later on, I think that this film, I'm going to say, is the, without Back to the Future 3, I think that this is the genesis of the entire Rick and Morty show that has, that it's a zeitgeisty show, Richard. People are talking about it. I'm connecting Back to the Future 3 with our contemporary moment. This is good podcasting. Stick with me.
I'm with you 100%.
Yeah, but and we can maybe, and I just want to bring this up early so we can find other instances of it throughout, but I think it's in the kind of tedious banality with which they approach time travel at the beginning of this movie, the sort of workaday boredom with which they approach all of these things, that in that you can feel that tonally, which isn't, there's a tremendous urgency. There's a little bit of fun in the future section, which is kind of silly in Back to the Future 2. But there's something about the fact that time travel feels old hat and they also feel very tired. And where this begins to manifest itself is like when the current, when again, there's multiple versions of Doc Brown in this movie,
right,
which feels very Rick and Morty in and of itself. But you see, 1950s Doc is like, what, it actually flew? And just the kind of bored Michael J. Fox, he's like 35 years old at this point, playing a high school student. And he's just like scratching his head. He's like, yeah, we had a hover conversion done in the early 20th century. And it's just very, just like, meh, that whole thing. And then later on, they go and they have to dig the thing out for where it's been buried for 65 years. And they're pulling that out, which is a fun sci-fi concept. And they look a little tired as Michael J. Fox heaves his shovel into the back of the thing. Uh-huh. Anyway, there's something about that workaday tedium that has to do with all of these big sci-fi things that just... it feels like that is the, it's the genesis of the tonal space in which all of that show would exist for a while.
It's interesting that the third one gave you that feeling, because I definitely got that feeling watching the second one, and it wasn't the meh time travel stuff. It was more how flippantly Doc Brown was with the space-time continuum. Like, just leave Jennifer on the porch. It'll be fine. Like, well, it'll come back here, and that's just how it works. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. So that's the feeling I got when I watched two. Yeah. The feeling I had watching three, you mentioned it's tonally different than the other two, and I think I mentioned this to you offline, but the relationship between Doc and Clara gave me some pretty strong Forrest Gump feels, and it felt like entering, like him stepping where you said giving the moments time to breathe a little bit, and we get like a romantic, several romantic moments with them that is designed to be romantic. It's not as part of a joke or anything. It's like that's crucial to the story, and it's treated very, very sincerely and very earnestly, which of course is all over Forrest Gump. Even this, rewatching it this morning, I heard the theme that played, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but when they're stargazing together, I was listening to the music in that scene, and it sounds really similar to the Forrest Gump theme, actually.
Well, maybe that's also part of it, is that laying the foundations for the score. It's, you know, it was fun to look. The other big takeaway for me was thematically how far more focused it feels than where we were going in part two, which returns us much more to part one, which feels very thematic, which is a film which kind of knows what it's trying to say, and a film that echoes, which kind of makes sense when you learn that these were all conceptualized as kind of one story originally, that this would be the conclusion, you know, of the sequel. It kind of echoes a lot more of the themes that we see in the first film, because we have, again, Doc, who is this, you know, this materialist, this scientist, this guy who can manipulate the world around him, who believes in, you know, nothing that is, you know, nothing that is uncanny, who then is sort of tipped first, you know, again, through the science fiction conceit, time travel conceit, that, you know, somehow, not only is he going to die, but he might like fall in love with someone, he says, remembered by his beloved Clara, like a week before he dies. And so he has to confront this idea of love at first sight or fate and all of this. And
destiny,
exactly. All of that kind of stuff. And so it's a film that begins to lift Back to the Future out of pure science fiction and into, you know, something that is a bit more supernatural, something that is a bit more kind of overtly a spiritual film.
And he said he's actually come out and said that the third one was supposed to be the more spiritual.
Okay, yeah, that one. Well, that is, yes, it is.
Definitely reads.
yeah. And I think that's, I don't know, but that is what's funny is you see that change in Doc, both in his view of needing, you know, of time travel itself, and his opinion about time travel sort of moves with his opinion of Clara and where that relationship is. But you see him, you know, at that moment, he gets tipped off that he's going to fall in love, you know, but remembered by this beloved Clara. He decides not to go meet the school teacher because her name is Clara. She's racing towards the canyon. He, you know, intervenes. He grabs her. It's love at first sight. Then he learns that's her name. And then in that moment, love, you know, this idea, what is Back to the Future? What is the part one? What is the song called? The Power
of Love. Yeah.
But love literally is, it both introduces for him as a character this, you know, some positive spiritual value to actually kind of define him, this love he has for Clara and then ultimately creating a family and all of that. But at the same time, introduces him, the scientist, and therefore the movie as a science fiction film, into the idea, introduces that whole the whole thing into the idea of there being a supernatural component innate within the very within the whole time travel conceit that the whole series is operated in. And that is just in that, like, there are yes, Doc Brown and Marty have been hopping in their cool science car and sciencing all around, you know, jumping between different dimensions and manipulating reality. And yet there is a some sort of plan or some sort of fate or some sort of point that they're being inevitably pulled towards if they stay on the righteous path. So that is, and that kind of retroactively redefines a tremendous a lot about the previous films, because mm-hmm. what therefore, you know, stuff like the lightning bolt striking, as we talked about in that whole episode, you know, literally the spiritual power coming back down to return what was lost, you know, as we went onto this dark path into the weird world where Marty lives at the beginning of the film, those things are no longer to be viewed as, you know, purely symbolic, but now are kind of part of the actual, you know,
text.
Diegetic, yeah. Spiritual world of the film. That, like, it is actually about the interplay between this scientist and spiritual forces as they're kind of spiraling through all of this stuff. And it kind of makes that statement explicitly. You know, it leaves it to be filled in, but sort of makes that statement explicitly in this film, which, again, after all the doohickery of part two, it was actually a very, very welcome surprise. I found myself much more dialed in watching three this time than I had been, and just very invested. And again, how can you not be invested? Mary Steenburgen is the lead in this film. I mean, fucking, I grew up with Parenthood, all of those sorts of things. Love the Steenburge, so... rocking.
That's just a
well told little love story. But yeah, I found myself, I did a much more drawn in and smitten with three than with two on this watch through. And maybe that's because I am also old now and perhaps have always been an old fuddy duddy scientist at heart.
Well, we've been friends for a really long time. You have grown,
Richard.
You have grown much more spiritual. In the last few years, like to a staggering extent, I'm really proud of you, Kyle.
Yeah, there you go, man.
But
it's a film is a spiritual medium. You just got to acknowledge it, man.
It's true. You've been talking about the real world and the spiritual world has been like the theme for you this year.
The screen is just a membrane that divides us from the spiritual world, Richard. And honestly, if you want the real like brass tacks version of it, it is merely that so much of the language of cinema has been written by people who were profoundly influenced by religious mm-hmm. iconography. All of your Spielbergs and your Bergmans and your Scorseses and your Zemeckises and your basically everybody. So it's difficult to engage in the history of cinema and the language of cinema that has existed up to this point if you are not conversant in the language of religious iconography and really its relationship to psychology and its relationship to philosophy and its relationship to history and its relationship to people, because that's kind of, and I think to bring it back home again, I think as is written throughout all of Back to the Future, especially the first and third film, you can see a lot of that stuff very, very present. And it enables you to see a little bit more of the what was there, man.
Right. And you can feel that Catholic upbringing in the movie's kind of playing with the it's destiny, but you also, Doc Brown says to Marty at one point, Marty, we all have to make decisions that alter the course of our lives. So it's wrestling this preordained future versus, do you have the power of free will to make the decisions to actually fundamentally change your life and change your destiny, which is mm-hmm. what Doc Brown does in this movie. He changes his destiny and his mm-hmm. opinion of time travel changes. He falls in love for the first time. And mm-hmm. yeah, dude, that love story. Mm. It really makes the movie work. And you mentioned it before too. It's not just him and Clara. Like, we finally get a window into Doc Brown's and Marty's relationship. They're hanging out and the tables get turned where Marty has to be the voice of reason, the voice of yes. science in the film.
Yes.
Doc, don't think with your heart, think with your head. You're a scientist. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah, I think that in that way, the film it feels like a really great, and I don't mean this as a criticism. I mean, it feels like a really great episode of a fantastic television show starring Doc and Marty. And it's at the same time a really wonderful conclusion to the trilogy, but because of the crazy scenario, it's the Old West, because the characters feel lived in and so they can play with them a little bit. Even that moment, and I know exactly what you're talking about, when Doc becomes a little bit silly, and Doc and Marty on the street, I forget exactly what the dialogue is, but basically Marty has to kind of bring him back down to earth again. And that, just that, those little character inversions and things are just, I don't know, fun, and it makes us like where the characters have been rather than just how the time parts stick together and stuff, which was also rad.
And you have that moment too where, like, they're talking about the tombstone out in front of the thing, when Marty's trying to be like, we have to go back, and Doc is like, someone still is gonna die, but it's just not me, and he's being measured for the the coffin. And you even get the great line reversal where Marty says, great Scott, and the Doc gets, it's heavy, isn't it? Line.
Mm. Yes. Beautiful. Oh, there stuff. You go. That's the line. Yes.
It's heavy. It's heavy.
Yep.
The other thing that I think, just to step back and talk about my history with the film, I always thought this was the boring one. But I became a huge, I don't think I've watched it since I went through a huge Sergio Leone phase in and post-college and in college. And so it was really wonderful.
You did, Richard.
Oh, man. And I think this was my introduction to the Back to the Future 3, I think, is my introduction to Clint Eastwood. Like, that was the first I saw of him. So like, I didn't realize it was just a silly, it wasn't even a joke for me back then. But now, watching with all of the Leone stuff kind of baked in my mind, there's so many beautiful beautiful homages to Leone's work, where the camera booms up over the train station as Marty arrived. It's very Once Upon a Time in the West.
The Back to the Future
rendition on the harmonica when we see the courthouse is Once Upon a Time in the West, obviously.
And there's plenty of character actors and things showing up. In fact, who is it? Harry Carey Jr., who was in many a John Ford film and was John Ford's punching bag on many a movie, is in that. And I was trying to, I know that he's in the movie, and I was reminded when I saw his name in the opening credits. And was he one of the three guys? He was the middle guy in the bar, right?
Yep.
That's what I thought he was. So, all three
of those guys are old hat Western dudes. And that guy on the right, his voice, that kind of weird raspy voice. That's the sheriff of Nottingham in the old animated Robin Hood, which is so pleasant to see, to put a face to that voice.
I feel like he was in a couple of Disney movies around that time, but
I love that man's voice.
Definitely hits a nostalgia spot hearing that. So,
and he's also a voice of the bullet, one of the bullets in Roger Rabbit, in Eddie Valiant's cartoon
that's
gun.
That's right. Nope, I can picture it. Yes, the one with the mustache.
The one
something.
With the mustache. One of them. Yeah.
One of them, one you of them. Know. One of the animated Western bullets. You get it.
I get it.
Oh,
and Burton Gilliam from Blazing Saddles is the Colt Peacemaker salesman.
To talk about the Western stuff, just the how preposterous and delightful it is that, you know, they just drive out to a desert, presumably adjacent to Hill Valley. And they are in Monument Valley suddenly. And so there's a little drive-in theater. And again, just as if the symbolism, again, it's not like we're making this shit up, Richard, as if they, you know, the symbolism couldn't be more overt in the previous two films, with the car driving straight down Main Street and then into the movie theater. Now, for no reason at all.
It's the one,
Brown,
the one gag. It's for the one gag.
Yes, but for no reason at all, Doc Brown has, in this desert, which is Monument Valley, which is loaded with all sorts of fun cinematic business, cinematic magic that we don't need to get into here, but for no reason at all, has him try to get up to 88 miles per hour.
With a wall in front of him.
Yes, with a wall directly in front of him. just like really like as if creating a trying to launch off of a fucking battleship, like a plane off of a battleship scenario when it was not necessary at all. Anyway, doesn't matter. But obviously the reason is because we want to maintain this symbol of the time travel is actually crossing through the screen into the spiritual world, into the internal, which is what is represented on screen in this movie. But, you know, I get this, which is, you know, it's and honestly, the fact that it makes no sense in reality, but it makes all the sense in the world symbolically. It makes me love that thing. And you know why it works? Because when, as you said, there is that one gag, the Indians who are painted on the wall disappear and are replaced by real Indians. And
which
that
is great.
Makes it work. Sure, it is really great.
And I never put together the Marty's costume was just like, that's what got worn in, that's the kind of costume that would have been in an old Western. That's why Doc Brown picks it, because it's the 50s and he saw them earlier. So of course it's going to be this unrealistic, silly, made for, he's put him in an old movie costume, an old dumb movie costume. That's what he's wearing. So you also get that.
Yep. Yes, indeed. And then, so we get the interesting arrangement of when he goes back, he meets Seamus, his great uncle. What is the relationship? I don't fucking remember.
I think it's his great grandfather, because I think William, the baby, his grandfather.
That's true. Yeah, and that was which is interesting because you have Michael J. Fox and Leah Thompson playing like husband and wife, but then he thought his grandfather was himself, but then learns that a hot-headed version of himself that he saw in a picture was actually gunned down, yada, yada, yada. It's stabbed with a Bowie knife.
Yes, exactly. Gruesome.
It's very gruesome. It is very gruesome. And that being the Seamus story feels like it doesn't get much love, but it's just another thing that's sort of there to explicitly begin to kind of tell you that we are introducing a kind of overtly cosmic, overtly spiritual aspect into this last act, because really Seamus serves almost no purpose other than to be drawn towards Marty's fate at the end. He kind of shows up in a restaurant, or where he showed in a restaurant.
I felt like I needed to be here. Like my future depended on it.
Like a future depended on it and all of that business. And again, which is cool. And I like threading all of that in.
Talk about that for a second, because when I used to think back on these movies pre-rewatching them for the show, I always thought it was ham-fisted is the wrong word, but Marty's mm-hmm. like fatal flaw of not being able to back down from a challenge mm-hmm. In the very explicit way that it's called out, is he doesn't let other people call him chicken. I always thought that was very silly. Mm-hmm. But there's something so beautiful, even if it is a bit that, even if I still feel it's a little silly, I still love it. But I think I love it because they transpose him in that shows the limits of that attitude by taking him back to the Old West. When something like that was said, it literally mm-hmm. means you're going to die.
Yeah. It's this thing. It's a thing that across the breadth of maybe a single story, you know, the chicken thing, because it kind of, the language of are you yellow, are you a chicken, kind of anticipates the Western setting, that if that had been the third act, you know, of a really long fucking version of the second movie, you could see how it would kind of work. But on its own, it feels like, yes, this attribute of Marty that kind of, I felt the same thing when I was a kid, it sort of pops up out of nowhere. But again, you know, I think the reason it never fully crystallizes for us as a legitimate attribute of Marty is still a symptom of the fact that it is Elizabeth Shue and not Marty who hides out in the house and witnesses the state of Marty's life,
right.
Which again, we talked about why I don't want to redo that from the second, from the last podcast, but Marty remains, and it continues into this film where again, Elizabeth Shue is on hand. What is the girlfriend's name?
Jennifer
is on hand so that she can react knowingly to his decision to not race flee from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And
Needles.
That of course is a direct echo, exactly. That is a direct echo of, you know, that little moment where she's hiding out previously. So our character remains, and there's something to be said for there. Is there something delightful about that dramatic irony of him not knowing, but not really in the sense that that decision, I don't know. I want Marty to, in order for Marty, and I kind of, we stressed this in the last one, to have had an arc that felt, you know, that felt similar to that in the first film, it would have been great for him to directly confront the potential of a banal future. The idea that he was, in the first film, he wanted to be a rock star and his dad was kind of a piece of shit. And then he made his dad like kind of a rad dude, but he still wants to be a rock star and all of that. And then it's like, okay, can you maintain that same optimism with the idea that maybe you're just going to be a dad yourself living in a suburban house? And Marty never really confronts that. And therefore he never has his fear of that transfigured into anything else, like an acceptance of Hill Valley or anything. And so he sort of floats above it all. And you know, it could be said that, you know, Doc and even Biff have more kind of transfiguring arcs than Marty does, as he kind of floats above these things.
Right.
But so these things, like the whole chicken thing, which only is relevant to the extent that it feeds directly into that Nichols, what, or I'm not Needles. Calling him Nichols, Flea from that whole thing with Flea.
Yeah.
The thing with Flea. It's only relevant because of the thing with Flea. So the fact that he's unaware of the thing with Flea and he's not there to see it, it feels like, I don't know. I feel like there's a circuit that's not connecting there.
And
I feel like it would all legit, like all that whole thing would light up if he had been the one hiding out in the house, seeing himself and been having to confront that.
Totally. And it, I totally feel you. And just talking through it, it feels like they were trying to save the the person confronting knowing about their future for Doc in this movie. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like that's Doc's arc in this film. And so they're trying to hold on to the, you cannot go back. You cannot know about your future. And that's coming from the first movie too. It's kind of trying to hold that idea so long for Doc to be able to have the well, now as a scientist, now that I've fallen in love and am experiencing things with my heart rather than my brain, it's okay to know about your future and then to actively make changes that better you. And in Doc's weird case, it's his past and his future at the same time. So there's some brain scrambling certainly that have happened with all time travel.
But I really found myself responding very positively to Doc's arc in this, and just digging the idea that in a movie, and again, that those two lines being transposed with, you know, Doc saying this is heavy, and Marty having to tell him exactly, and Marty getting it, but that sort of, I don't know, that's the whole movie in a nutshell, in the sense that it's just fun to, how do you take two characters that you already love and have them, you know, go through a story that feels fresh and feels new? And yes, does feel different, but what is the thing? It's not, people say, and we even kind of said it at the beginning, you know, it's like, oh, it's a film that sits still, or it's a film that this, or it's a film that that. I don't know if any of that's actually true. I mean, we're still talking about a goddamn movie that has a fucking train chase thing at the end and all sorts of the West and people being dragged around on horses and all sorts of shit. So it's, I don't know if that's even true. I think one of the reasons it feels slightly different is because, you know, the heart of Back to the Future is in Marty, and Doc is sort of running around as this sort of mechanism that is facilitating a lot of these things. And that changes, it shifts, it inverts in this one, where the heart of the film rests in Doc and Marty again. And this is maybe something that would feel different if he had had more of that kind of being confronted with his future thing in Back to the Future too. But Marty again kind of is there more as is there to not totally to facilitate Doc's arc, but kind of, you know, he's more of the object that Doc needs to send back to the future than he is. Anyway, point being, man, that I like the fact that Doc himself feels different in this. He literally changes. He literally, it could be no, it is the most acute change that could happen. 1 second he is one way, and then immediately after seeing Clara, he is transfixed, staring at her, immediately making decisions that are contradictory to the decisions he made previously. It is it's a delightful way to write familiar characters, because it is essentially like they are under some sort of curse or spell. So we delight in seeing Doc behave in a way that is anti-Doc. We delight in seeing Marty behave in a way that is sort of anti-Marty. And it's a fun and delightful way to sort of what starts out as just sort of silly is clearly directing us towards something that is not only, I think, good from a character standpoint, deeply thematically resonant, but also just sort of a bold and interesting and kind of really a provocative creative decision for what is ostensibly a science fiction franchise. I mean, it's obviously very much present in the first film as well, but kind of to introduce this supernatural uncanny element that ties it all back together while having a character kind of through love explicitly having that kind of like return to sort of faith and belief in something beyond yada yada yada. I don't know. It's cool, man.
There's a quote I've found from Zemeckis in 2016, which I kind of slotted in that this is the episode for it, considering the Doc's arc. The thing that makes love stories work, in my opinion, in movies, novels, country, Western songs, is the feeling of longing. We have to evoke the feeling of longing, that painful feeling. And that's what we as humans understand as love. No one can actually define love, but you attempt to. And the closest thing you can get to is longing. And that itself has a melancholy to it. You could say dread or doom. It's that feeling we all feel when we fall in love with somebody and we have this horrible, fearful feeling that we will never have that person in our life again.
Interesting.
Which is that finds like what happens to Doc throughout the whole thing and why Marty has to come in and be the voice of reason. Doc is literally, he's a man out of time and finds his woman and takes her out of time.
Yes. Well, I also just like that. I really dig that quote because it's sort of a way to sort of take this very abstract emotional idea of love and say, how can you actually concretize that in a story? How can you make that manifest? And it has to be manifest in action or a fear of something actually happening or some incident actually happening. And I dig about that is he's saying, well, love is only manifest as love on screen if there's a fear of that love going away, because then you can see the character actually act in furtherance of wanting to maintain that value as it's potentially slipping away, which is a really deft point to be made, and you can see it in action in this film, which is really cool.
Also Forrest Gump too. We'll return to it when we do Forrest Gump next.
Yeah.
But yes, I have been saving that quote for some time, Kyle.
I liked it, Richard. It was a good quote. Read it again just so the people can
it's
know.
It's too long.
No, read it again, Richard.
The thing that makes love stories work is a feeling of longing. You have to evoke the feeling of longing, the painful feeling, and that's what we as humans understand as love. No one can define love, but you attempt to, and the closest thing you get is longing. And that itself has a melancholy to it. You can say dread or doom. It's the feeling we feel when we fall in love with somebody. We have this horrible, fearful feeling that we will never have that person in our life again. I think I'm adding the again, but...
I'll add to that. So we just watched, if you want a fantastic example of that, because now my mind's kind of going on this. If you look at William Wyler's adaptation of Wuthering Heights, watched that the other night. Cliff wanted to rewatch that as because it's relevant to something we're writing. And man, I'm glad we did. A fantastic movie. Must see. Fantastic story, but it is entirely a story about this perpetually pulled apart, unrequited love. It's not actually unrequited. It's very requited and then pulled away by society and all these other things as the people are right in their face, but constantly as Kathy and Heathcliff, everyone had to, many people read the book in school. I'm sure they know the story.
I did.
Yes. Yes, anyway, but being pulled apart. Anyway, fantastic story. Very, 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 very powerful. And now I'm just sort of quickly just just looking at it again through that the lens of that quote. It's a fantastic way of looking about it. Because I and sorry, to kind of clarify, that film is in this fantastic love story that fills you with these intense, intense emotions of feelings of love and longing and the desire for Kathy and Heathcliff to be together, and they cannot, yada, yada, yada. And it's just, it's so potent, it almost feels like weaponized. And that's both, obviously, the original story. That's that's William Wyler doing a fucking incredible job with the film. Some of the things, he says this incredible way, we're not here to talk about Wuthering Heights, Richard. We're not here to talk about William Wyler. Anyway, fantastic movie. But again, it's so potent. It makes you, if you're a filmmaker, want to sort of pull it apart and just say, like, how did this get me so hard? And I think that a lot of my thoughts on that from the other day were clarified by that Zemeckis quote. Because yes, the love, and I mean, it's a lot of love stories are about unrequited love. That's Romeo and Juliet. That's everything. But just to say that that longing is sort of the only way to present it on screen, or for as a way of doing it, is really cool. And you can see that writ through a lot of his work, certainly.
From totally. Totally.
Rad.
Kyle, I love Biff in this movie so much.
Biff is really good in this movie.
I kind of hold it as the perfect thing. When he shoots Marty at the, mm-hmm. not to jump to the end of the film, but when he shoots Marty, his celebration, the performance of his celebration is so...
Yes.
Glah. It's just...
Yeah.
The perfect thing. Just just looking for love and adoration. He's really proud of himself for shooting an unarmed man. And all of his slobbering and yelling. I love Biff in the first one and the second one, but man, I don't think he gets credit for knocking these characters out of the park, especially this one.
The actor's
Biff.
Name is what? Tom
Thomas Wilson.
Thomas Wilson, yeah. Tom Ivey, he is fantastic in all of these goddamn things. This admittedly is one of my favorite versions of Biff. And I think, I mean, because he's fucking, it's a fucking Western, but I think it's also the fact that it feels very lived in, both from a performance standpoint, because this would have been, he would have been playing Biff or some version of him now for, I think, 12 years at this point. There's also the fact that all the other versions of Biff were like, the makeup in the film was fantastic, but they always had like a slightly fakey, plasticky quality to them. Whereas this Biff feels so lived in. He's so dirty, and his mustache is so big.
Mustache.
it's the goddamn mustache. He feels lived in. The performance feels very, very good and lived in. And I don't know. It's top Biff for me. It's one of my top Biffs.
It's top Biff for me personally. Also shoot you down like a duck. And I want to start saying this line to other people. Let me find it. I wrote it down.
It's less screechy than the other Biffs as well. Less screamy.
You gutless yellow pie slinger. I'm going to start using that as an insult.
I'm going to start calling people by what he says. Not some dude it out. Fucking, I'm going to say dude it out. I like that.
I mentioned this at the outset, Kyle, but I think it's worth kind of going back to Back to the Future 3 kind of gets rid of a lot of the kind of special effects stuff that I kind of felt that bogged down too a little bit, forcing in the effects and things, and gets back to a simpler story. There's not all these effects happening, and it feels like he's kind of unleashed again, being able to move the camera and do, there's a lot of stunts in the movie that are really great. Apparently when they decided to do a Western, all of the stunt guys got super stoked on it because everybody wants to make a Western. Zemeckis himself says every director wants to make a Western. And apparently they did this one because, Michael J. Fox said he wanted to be in a Western, which is how we ended up writing the Western part.
And you can see that right away when when Marty goes back, what is the first thing Marty encounters? You know, a row of Indians being chased by a row of cavalry, and it's like just like you know, very strongly evokes, you know, My Darling Clementine, or not My Darling Clementine, one of my things, Shore, Yellow Ribbon, and a bunch of other John Ford movies, did a bunch of cavalry movies. And when you watch those movies, the sense you get is, man, that looks like a lot of fun. Because like a lot of the sequences of the movies are just guys riding over hills in Monument Valley, like down canyons and kicking up dust and like bringing wagons over rocks and all sorts of stuff. And you can tell, and you know, historically, they only, that John Ford would only do like one take of each of these things, that they was just,
oh, I didn't know
just
that.
See what fucking happens, you know, and they would just go over a hill and just see what fucking happens on a bunch of horses. And it feels, it has a, there's a, there is a subtle just underneath just boys having fun energy with a bunch of horses, a bunch of wagons and shit out in the desert. So you, and again, we, how does he get there? He's in Monument Valley driving into a goddamn movie screen. But then as soon as he gets there, that stunt where he puts the car under the cave, and then all of those cavalry guys just come dive bombing over the hill, just jumping horses and shit. It's like immediate, like he's getting that John Ford fun in there immediately, which is and it was, I had the same reaction. I was like, man, that looks like fun.
And then you have him being drugged through the city streets, which looks like it hurts really bad. And he gets Michael J. Fox actually wanted to perform his own stunt on the hanging bit. And apparently going back to like Romancing the Stone, where some stunt folks almost kick the bucket when the car drives off of a cliff, apparently when Michael J. Fox did the hanging stunt, he didn't have his arm in the right spot, and he like passed out. So
it looked gnarly.
Yeah, because it was, apparently. And even beyond just the being drugged on by the horse and the cavalry and stuff, man, the train, I love the train action sequence at the end of this, end of the film. You can see, there's like moments where you can, if you're really watching hard, you can see a stuntman. But for the most part, it's Christopher Lloyd and Michael J. Fox on a train, like, that's barreling down the tracks. And you get it. Thinking about it, watching it, and knowing that he said that Mary Steenburgen riding a horse and trying to grab a moving train was one of the most stressful shots that he's ever had to get. And watching that stuff kind of reminded me of that moment with Beef in Used Cars, where he said his scrotum just kind of lifted up into his body because it felt that dangerous. And I think a lot of that really reads very, very strongly, and makes me wonder if it's him putting himself in all these crazy stunt positions where performers are doing cool looking dangerous things that maybe lent him to going to the Polar Expresses and Beowulfs and all that. Just thinking ahead about like his stunt work, I'm trying to kind of project into the future. After Death Becomes Her, I don't know that we get a whole lot of crazy stunt stuff.
I don't know, do we?
I'm trying to think ahead.
In Forrest Gump, we get a little bit of some cars chasing people down and stuff, but aside from that, I don't know.
And the war stuff.
Yeah, we get a lot of Flight, there might be some interesting stuff in the crash sequence.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but it's been a while since I visited Flight. I can't remember how much of that was just CGI, but I'd like to think he tossed some people around inside of a plane. I remember that happening.
They did the Apollo 13, where they're just up, they take the actual plane upside down.
Yes, exactly.
To get the effect. Who knows? Maybe they did. I don't know. I don't know anything about Flight, how it was made.
Oh, and something we have not talked about yet, and maybe the most important thing, Richard, maybe the most important thing in the whole film is the appearance of ZZ Top.
Oh, yes. All the best movies have a Texas connection.
That's right. They have to, Richard. That's the only way they can be good, because Texas is obviously God's country, and you have no spiritual magic in your film if you do not have Texans in there. And they don't just have Texans. They have three actual Texas wizards in the movie, which accounts for why they were able to bring this trilogy in so strong at the end. So you see ZZ Top, which is rad, and that dance sequence. And I think this might be the only time in like the last 45 years you've seen ZZ Top without sunglasses.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I, I have watched like twice on Netflix that ZZ Top documentary, The Best Little Band in Texas or whatever it's called, Sam Dunn's documentary, which if you haven't seen it, see it. It's fucking rad. But I was thinking, like, I just could barely remember what Billy Gibbons' face looked like underneath his sunglasses. Mm. And then you see it in Back to the Future 3 because I had the Blu-ray. It was very clear, Richard. I have a big TV.
Startling clarity.
Startling clarity
on Billy Gibbons' face.
Imagine if I watched it in 4K, Richard, what I would be able to see. But
every pore of Billy Gibbons' face.
And I was watching it with Cliff, and I pointed and I said, "Hey, that's what Billy Gibbons' face looks like. Look at that." They also had a song over the closing credits.
Double back.
That's right. Yeah. Double back, and
the
that
classic ZZ Top song.
Yeah, and again, that just fits because there's again when you. It almost doesn't make sense that there wasn't more ZZ Top in the previous films. Because when you think about the 80s, when you think about that Eliminator album, Sharp Dressed Man, Gimme All Your Lovin', it feels like a very similar energy to those first couple of Back to the Future films. And so
maybe two. We could fit in two.
Yeah, there you go.
At Biff's Pleasure Palace, probably. That was the crowd.
That's right.
I read that they had a camera issue while ZZ Top was on set, and so Michael J. Fox asked them to just play something, and they ended up having like a 2-hour jam session.
Nice.
Just like had a little party. I mean, they're shooting a party sequence, but it turned into this little party sequence, and eventually, after like 2 hours, Michael J. Fox was like, "Hey, do you guys fix that camera thing?" And Zemeckis was like, "Oh, yeah, we fixed it a while ago. I just didn't want to step on you guys having fun."
I love that story. That is my favorite story now from the production of this film. Because if you have ZZ Top and they have instruments, why not shut down production and have them play? Fun story. And this will prove to you, by the way, that they are wizards, in fact, ZZ Top. Years ago, Eric Clapton would come, and maybe he did it for more years, but he did it a few years, would come and do this big guitar concert festival thing in Dallas. Mm-hmm. What's one of the big domes or bowls? What's the big bowl in? There's one of the bowls in Dallas.
Cotton
I don't
bowl?
Remember which
the
one.
The Cotton Bowl?
I think it was there. He would do these big concerts and everything. And one of the years I went to go see it, and he would have, and like, it would be like Eric Clapton and Carlos Santana and B.B. King and John Mayer and, man, why John Mayer? I have no idea. But, and ZZ Top this one particular year. In fact, everyone I mentioned was actually fucking there. I mean, maybe Jeff Beck was there too. I don't know. It was a long time ago, Richard.
I feel you.
But the whole the concert was clearly building towards a big wank off at the end where all of the guitar players were going to be on stage together. And that would have been rad to see. But what they did not count on the fact is that ZZ Top opens for no one. So ZZ Top, which is a rule I just made up.
Richard. I mean, I would believe that it's true.
Yes. They have to headline everything because, again, they're Texas Wizards. So. And this is in Dallas, of course. So as they take the stage, literally a Texas thunderstorm starts swirling into the Cotton Bowl. Huge winds and whatever. ZZ Top play their entire set all the way through, bring the house down, and then literally as soon as ZZ Top leave, clearly not planned, some fucking roadie runs on stage and hurriedly shouts into the microphone, "I want to thank everyone for coming out to the Eric Clapton Guitar Festival this year, but due to weather, safety shuts down. Everyone drive safe and get out of your cars this fast." And then like runs off, and then huge storm blows in. So again, that was an actual thing that happened in reality and is evidence just like Clara being saved from the canyon that we are living in a simulation.
I'm going to let the silence hold on that for a little bit.
There you go, Richard. You got it.
So they didn't play. ZZ Top didn't play. They just...
No, they played their full set. ZZ Top played their full set. And then...
Oh, it was immediately after.
Ended,
oh, yeah. It was after. I thought they were coming
on. There
was
clearly going to be... Like, there was going to be more shit after. There was going to be Eric Clapton coming out, other people. And I'm sure it would have been magical. And
oh, right. Because they don't open for anybody. So the show had to close.
Exactly.
They summoned the
They
the
summoned
lightning.
The storm, Richard. You get it.
I get
you
it.
See movies.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, good for them.
Good for them. They summoned the storm.
They didn't want to open for Clapton.
No.
Who would?
He had his time. He was on stage already. He was on stage all night prior to that. So,
I want to touch on two things, and it's things blowing up. The train going off the cliff, seeing that blow up was awesome.
That was. There's that. It feels like a full-size train.
It does, doesn't it? Like,
yeah, yeah. Is it a miniature train? Or
I don't know. It looks like a big train.
We should know this, but it buckles when it hits the ground. Like, it's very heavy.
Right. So, yes. So that's cool to see, and definitely feel him doing the more stunty thing from Romancing the Stone and Used Cars. And man,
at least if this had been Robert Zemeckis though 10 years earlier, there would have been like five people riding Slumdog Millionaire style on top of the train, jumping off as it went over. They'll be fine. Give them a parachute.
It's all right. It's all right. And I had forgotten that the DeLorean gets completely obliterated. Which is, I don't think that's a miniature. I think they actually obliterated that car.
They had a lot of money to throw around.
I mean, apparently I think it was three. There's like three picture cars, and one of them just got, decimated with 14 cameras on it. And there's something satisfying with all of the talk about, I should have never invented the infernal machine. It's caused nothing but pain. Just to have it be completely incinerated. I just, for whatever reason, I had forgotten about that, that it was just destroyed.
Yes, and it's also fun, though, that, you know, his view, like, the machine itself, like when does that moment come? When he's like, the infernal machine, I never should have made it. It's right after he has to, like, reject Clara's love. So it actually, and again, it helps point to what is the time machine. Is it a time machine, or is it the thing that allows you to cross to the other side of the screen or the other side of the interior of the self? In the same way that Marty gets in the time machine, and as a result, he has to explore his feelings about his parents and all that other side and then come back out having dealt with all of that stuff. It's a psychedelic trip, that goddamn car. Doc himself, when he is confronted with the idea that he chose for the first time in the whole series to explore the inner depths, to explore his heart. And now, for the first time ever, he's just overtly down on time travel. He's I never should have created this thing. I should have destroyed it, yada, yada, yada. It's not just about time travel. It's about the fact that oh crap, I never should have created this thing that allows me to explore the interior of the self. So clearly he's talking about LSD.
I mean, that makes sense. I mean,
it does.
Did you see how he comes back dressed? Like freaking Willy Wonka, dude. But I think that's something that I took note of too, because the fact that he shows up at the end of the film with a time train, there's all this talk about how damaging time travel is, and like his central arc is, his central decision that he has to make is,
right. It does make that the meaning of the time train suddenly. Go ahead, continue.
Right. But, he has to decide between love or his career and the thing that he spent all of his time doing. And then we get the time train at the end, which is, nothing is inherently bad. Because of who we are, we can have, you can have all the things. You just have to make the right decisions. Mm-hmm. It's not magic.
It's because it changes, and this is worth talking about. It maybe is the most fundamental thing that this film changes, and I think it's a kind of cool thing about it. Is what do we think of when we think of time travel movies, or what do we get even often when we see this same sort of territory being run over with something like a Rick and Morty or whatever it is? We see this, this very kind of somewhat materialistic but also sort of nihilistic view of the world, where all of our connections or relationships are kind of arbitrary and could be knocked off of course very easily because everything's a fucking accident and everything's chaos and nothing has meaning, yada, yada, yada. That's sort of often kind of innate in a lot of different time travel stories that exist. But in this, by kind of tipping it again towards something a little bit more spiritual, it changes the meaning not only of Doc Brown's character, as through love he begins to realize that maybe there's other shit at work beyond what he's doing, but it also changes the meaning of what the time machine is. It makes more that is that is, in a sense, the subtle version in Back to the Future 1 of the thing kind of running into a movie theater crystallizes into it literally for no reason at all running into a movie screen in Monument Valley, yada, yada, yada. And where it's a fun joke, but it's also packed with all sorts of delightful meaning that on the other side of the screen, he sees just literally what had been painted on the wall. It means that the time machine is that method for examining and changing that sort of the interior self. It is that lens through which you use to look at the self, just like, and it is his work. And that's something I think that a lot of filmmakers can relate to, that the work itself is a way of sort of examining the interior self and all of that. And what do we see? The time train becomes a critical part of the conclusion of the movie, just because Doc is trying to make that decision. You know, he's trying to make that decision at the end when he falls out of love with Clara, has to reject love and reject that kind of meaning. He's like, God damn it, time travel, looking to the interior of the self, all of that, don't want it, no good. And it seems like for a moment the film sort of metaphysically confirms that fact. When a train comes along, it smashes the DeLorean, it feels like the conclusion, it feels like the end of the adventure, it's closed, we never should have messed with this kind of stuff, yada, 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 we never should have looked in the mirror, we never should have whatever. And then, boom, what do we get? The biggest time machine. Not just another DeLorean, but a time machine that's must be more time machine-y because it's clearly so much longer and bigger. A giant phallic time machine covered with purple shit and doohickeys spinning around.
Just blowing steam everywhere.
Yeah.
Loads of steam.
Yeah, man. But again, why? Because Doc, and what do we see? We see Doc now with it, and what emerges from this time machine? Again, what is the time machine, Richard? The time machine is the examination of the interior self, the spiritual side. What exists on the other side of the movie screen? It's a way to get there. You know, that fantasy visualization of how things can and ought to be that we see on the other side of the movie screen. And by having faith in that, he suddenly has a wife, he's got two kids who look like little demons, but we don't have to talk about that right now. And he has this rad time train. So it basically says that thing that he was almost convinced he, after taking a small peek, was going to shut the door on forever, he now realizes he has cultivated it. He has grown it. It has developed within him. And now he has this robust spiritual awakening that is like physically manifest in this badass time train.
And which he has because, to kind of hit on some of the things that you and I have talked about personally during the pandemic, and certainly with your kind of going back through the John Ford stuff, the time machine becomes a wholly positive, optimistic thing when he shares it with somebody else. It's there's a the family is now involved, and it's now the family is in, or Doc's family is now involved. And I think you kind of hit on something on Back to the Future 1. We were talking about the end of that film. It's like you have to remain ever vigilant. And I think looking at the movies as a trilogy, right? Because we have the same moment played in all three films, it's there is a natural tendency for history to repeat itself and for us to fall into the same traps as our parents. And if we're not hyper vigilant of our past, we are destined to repeat them, repeat the mistakes of our past. And Doc's deciding to change himself and embrace Clara, like, leads to it suddenly becoming an optimistic thing too.
Yeah, and the other thing that's just rad about it is, like, they didn't have to do that with Doc. Doc could have been this weird asexual, you know, fucking professor character who was just lingering in the background. And it's a risk, but it's one that pays off because now you've loaded so much affinity and so much history and so much everything into this character that the moment he sort of meets Clara and suddenly falls in love and all this, you have which we were not expecting for him as a character, don't think. Because there's not a lot that points to that, but that he's not going to be alone and he's going to have this new, more robust life and all of these interior dimensions, yada, yada, yada. We have all of this. What we didn't realize we were setting up the whole time is this delightful, you know, all this potential energy just coming into this film that once it's unleashed, we're like, holy shit, look, I want Doc to end up with Mary Steenburgen. Mary Steenburgen is the perfect wife for Doc. I know they call her Clara Clayton or something like that, but we all know what it means, Richard, is that
clarity.
Doc deserves to
it's
end
clarity.
Up with... yes, clarity. Clara Clayton, clarity. Ha, ha. I love it, Richard. That's fantastic.
Right?
Yes. Oh, it's absolutely true. Oh, yeah, for sure. 100%. Yeah. Clarity.
But clarity. Yeah. He finds it. Good for him.
He finds it. Good. Eastwood Ravine.
Eastwood Ravine. Clint Eastwood.
Named for the man who robbed a train, disconnected the front car, rode the train, dive-bombed spectacularly into a canyon, as was attested by his friend and accomplice, local blacksmith, Doc Brown. Who was not jailed or did something to, I don't know.
Well, he was wearing a mask.
That's right. It was the other crazy-eyed, white-haired man in a tall hat who had visited that guy a day before to ask about robbing the train.
I do love that. That guy's performance in the, well, if you needed to get up that fast, that... I'm sure you could probably do it, Freaky Fred, over there. Got it up to 70.
That's just a great fucking scene. It's just like that guy selling it, talking about breaking off the cars, pushing in. And again, how does he make it fun? I love the little logs that blow up to give the little bursts of acceleration. So you have those moments.
And colored smoke coming out of the coming out of the thing.
I know. It's delightful. I love it.
It's beautiful, wonderful stuff. I want to talk about the drinking aspect of this movie. The just the silly gag of how many has he had? None. He just likes holding it.
Yes. and I like it. It also echoes that what moment in Roger Rabbit,
right.
With the one shot knocking him out. I love that. It's Judge Doom can't hold his liquor either, and that's delightful.
And you get that wonderful stunt of him falling into the thing and the wake-up juice. Joey, make us some wake-up juice.
Yes.
I didn't realize this. That's actually a bottle of Tabasco. Like, it's a bottle of Tabasco. I didn't realize it existed back then, but apparently it did. That's a period bottle of Tabasco.
Absolutely.
Wake-up juice. That's just
wake
a reflex.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, Joey.
Yep. No, it is rad. And you get that extra Zemeckis punch in that moment with that rad stunt where he falls through the table. And it's just a table fall, but just cutting to it abruptly and having him just knock the top off the table and throw drinks, it just adds so much. It amplifies, like we keep talking about. The skateboard has to run into the plutonium and go clack to really make sure you're paying attention.
Oh,
it's delicious.
And that's another thing I noticed. I forgot that there was the opening shot of Back to the Future in the middle of this movie, just with all steampunky Western stuff where bacon is being dropped onto the skillet and we reveal Marty sleeping on the couch.
Yes.
The couch in the workshop.
Whatever it is, yeah.
I love how the movies all kind of tie together. I think it's a pretty amazing feat that they, like, to steal the George Lucas line, the like different stanzas of a poem, they rhyme.
Yes. Oh, yeah, for sure. I do like, it's worth calling out the over-engineered ice maker, which I loved as a kid. And it's also, because it's simultaneously, it's a wonderful gag, but it lets you know in advance. It's also just good storytelling, because as they're about to embark on yet another quest to get the DeLorean up and running, how do you make that feel fresh? Well, how do you communicate how much impossibly harder everything is in the West than it is today? Well, you take something that people take utterly for fucking granted, you know, ice, you know, just ice. It's just this ice water, you know, and you see that he has had to build a machine the size of a barn using all of his genius and all of this work and all of this steam to create one ice cube. And it's a way to it's a gag, but it really quickly crystallizes in the audience's mind. That, like, oh shit, they have to build a time machine in this place where the ice is hard.
It's not just one ice cube. It's one brown ice cube.
Yes. one pretty shitty ice cube. One that it's like it was clearly left on the counter for a bit and some of it evaporated. That kind of ice cube.
Anything else? Have we hit everything you wanted to talk about?
Yes, we did talk about ZZ Top, and that was my entire list. So,
We've hit the stunts and everything. I think we've done this.
We have talked about Back to the Future 3 successfully, Richard.
We have done it. I've enjoyed revisiting this one very, very much, and I'm it comes at a good time when we're going into the holidays, and it's just a nice. This movie was a good pick me up for some hard weeks.
It's a good Thanksgiving movie for sure.
I think next up is Forrest Gump. I think it's our next pod.
Woo! All right.
Dude.
Well, I'm excited for that one. That's what it's all about, Richard. It's all been about Forrest Gump. Have you finished the novel yet, Richard?
I did. I finished it a few days ago.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to pick your brain about that. Because again, and I can't emphasize this enough, I have not read the book or any of the books.
Yes.
How many books have you read for this podcast, Richard?
Forrest Gump, The Witches.
Perfect.
Who Censored Roger Rabbit?
That's three so
I think,
far.
I think it's the three. And then I'm staring at Contact, which I'm going to read next. Which
very cool.
I don't know that I ever knew that it was a Carl Sagan novel, Contact.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. Cliff was a big sci-fi person when I was a kid, and you know, got the Space News periodical in the mail and was super dialed into. So I only knew Contact as like it's this Carl Sagan something or other, and it was sort of only integrated with my Zemeckis concept in my brain, I think, when I was in later adolescence.
But yeah, so I'm going to read Contact too. But first up,
you
Forrest
need
Gump.
To, Richard.
I do need to. I feel like I like I've been on this adaptation kick for a while. It started with, I think, the movie Carol. I saw Carol and wanted to read the Highsmith novel, A Price of Salt, for whatever reason. Why? I don't know why, but...
Because you felt at heart you were a lesbian in the 50s?
I don't think there's anything untrue about that statement.
It does make sense, yes. Kind of a 50s person, you know, and you're kind of a lesbian. I get it, Richard. I mean, I'm willing to make that connection for you.
I've had a lot of lesbian haircuts in my life, I feel.
You have had and continue to have many lesbian haircuts, yes, Richard.
It'll keep going. But yeah, let's wrap this thing up. Forrest Gump next. I've already watched it twice, Kyle. I'm excited to watch it three more times.
Perfect.
Not
good,
to spoil
good.
It, but I love Forrest Gump.
Just for the sake of consistency, I will continue to hurriedly watch the film once immediately before the podcast. So
I think it's good.
I think it works.
You're
it works
better,
for me.
You're better at watching movies than I am, so you only need to do it the once.
I only want to do it. I want to get that fresh reaction. I want to get that fresh energy, Richard. I don't like preparing for anything.
is there any paperwork involved? I'm not into it.
Yes, exactly. I'll get back to you in 11 days.
11 days, 2 months, whatever.
Is this absolutely necessary? It's just a signature, Kyle. All right.
All right, buttheads. Well, thanks for listening. Buttheads, follow the show at Bob Zemeckis on Instagram. We're posting a whole bunch of really poorly photoshopped posters of the movies for each episode.
It takes
way too long of my time. Kyle, how do people follow you?
I am at Mr. Kyle Bogart on a rather inert Instagram account at the moment, but they can follow me by following my lead and listening to ZZ Top.
Great. What album do they start with?
Ooh, good question, Richard. If you like things that are a little bit poppier, a little bit more 80s vibes, you're going to want to go with Eliminator. But the classic is Tres Hombres that opens with LaGrange. So you're going to want to go with Tres Hombres for more of a 70s authentic Texas-y vibe.
What about the, don't they have some more psychedelic stuff?
Yeah, they have a lot of weird, crazy out there albums and all sorts of shit. So, but those are two good entry points for most folks. And then expand. Another good entry point is watch that documentary on Netflix, ZZ Top, Best Little Band in Texas. I don't know why I can't get the name right all of a sudden, but directed by Sam Dunn, who also made the great Rush documentary, Beyond the Lighted Stage. Same guy. Watch that Rush documentary about 12 times. Now I've watched the ZZ Top documentary 3 times. I think I might watch it again right after this, Richard. I can't. I have other things I have to do. I'm not.
You could meditate on it.
I could meditate on it. I certainly could. I'll leave it on in the background while pretending to do emails. How about that?
I think that's a great plan.
Cool. All right. I'm going to go with that one then.
All right. Well, let's get out of here. Later, buttheads.
Later.